Our celebration of the show's 15th birthday continues on Insight Today, a civics lesson from guests who turn some otherwise dry or confusing topics into something pretty interesting. We'll tackle school receivership first, what it is, what steps lead up to it, and why a district would or wouldn't want to be in it. Then municipal bonding and bonds. Those are words you've heard often, right? Well, can you explain bonding in a few sentences? You might be able to after you hear this segment. In our second half hour, housing code enforcement. It's a dirty and sometimes dangerous job. Former Cap Radio reporter Amy Quinton shadowed a housing code enforcer. We'll recue her piece. And finally, how affordable housing issues in California have been made worse by wildfires. I'm Beth Ruryak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruryak. Welcome to an hour that we call the civics class. These are topics that aren't necessarily flashy or exciting, but they are important to understand. And we talked with people who made them seem less confusing. See what you think. First up, school receivership. California school districts that get into financial trouble have this option. It's not bankruptcy, and it doesn't happen often, but it is an emergency strategy that can keep a district afloat. In May of 2019, I talked with Karen Moore, director of the School Fiscal Services Division for the California Department of Education. She explained that there are annual financial reviews and checkpoints in place long before a district would get to receivership.
There are also measures that are taken throughout the year to make sure that a district is on track or to try and counsel them if they kind of go off track. So their annual budget is prepared and adopted by the district governing board. It is then reviewed and approved by the County Office of Education. And then in addition to that annual review of the budget, there are two interim reporting periods where two times during the year, the district kind of updates their fiscal status, and the county has an opportunity at those times as well to look and assess how the district is doing fiscally. So they're looking at not just the current year, but the subsequent 2 years as well. So it kind of gives them a look into the future if things look like they're turning.
It's important to make a distinction in the word superintendent, that sometimes we have the state superintendent and then we have the county superintendent. They're two different bodies.
Correct.
And they will also be monitoring a specific school district. The county's monitoring as a district is moving through its crises, its audits, and then at some point, there's going to be a decision made that, can I call it a rescue or an emergency action needs to happen?
Yeah.
And then what happens next? Let's say the district runs out of cash. The trigger is present.
These things don't typically happen overnight, right? People are aware there is kind of a crisis of sorts that's brewing. And often the district, with the help of the county and sometimes the help of the state, are able to turn things around. So that's always the goal. So there's lots of intervention that happens along the way, and it could take quite a long period of time for something to actually get to such a point.
That is what the ultimate goal here is, that there will be an emergency loan made to the school district.
Well, that's kind of the last resort. If nothing else works, then yes.
In the meantime, there's a phrase called negative certification. And if a school goes into negative certification, then what is the status?
A school district can be, they're certified as positive, qualified, or negative. So positive means they're fine. They're going to be able to meet their obligations for the current and two subsequent years. Qualified is they may not make their obligations for the current or two subsequent years. Negative is they won't, without some action, meet their obligations for the current or the immediate subsequent fiscal year. So districts are negative sometimes. It's not a common thing necessarily, but it doesn't necessarily foretell bankruptcy. There are some every year. We don't have bankruptcies every year. I think we've had 9 in the last 18 years. The negative status is, you know, there are usually several a year. I think the high was 13 one year back in the tough economic times. I think we had almost 200 districts that were in a qualified status. So it's a early warning system, and it usually works, and usually things are able to resolve themselves without needing a state loan.
The negative certification originates at the county level?
Well, typically the agency self-certifies for themselves, whether they think they're positive, qualified, or negative. Their oversight agency can change that certification if they disagree.
So back to the concept of receivership. Ultimately, there's going to have to be a loan, but the loan requires a piece of legislation.
Correct.
So it seems logical that if a school district is working on a loan, they're also talking with a lawmaker to work out some sort of legislation. And that also says that every school that goes into receivership would have a unique bill connected to it for its loan.
Correct. Yes.
And then lawmakers will discuss it. It has to be approved. It goes to the governor's desk. All that sounds like it could take a lot of time.
These things can happen fairly quickly. It depends, for starters, if the legislature is in session. That is important. But these are typically urgency bills that can move fairly quickly through the legislative process. So we hope that it doesn't come to where they need a state loan. People are aware. The county office is intimately involved. The state has a role. Probably their legislators already know that this district is in financial crisis. And I'm speaking generally. I think everybody is looking to exhaust all measures to make sure that they can make whatever cuts that they need to make, that if there's borrowing that can happen without needing a state loan, that that can happen. And then when all of those avenues are exhausted, then the state loan becomes a reality. And things can move fairly quickly, I think. People agree that we need to make this happen. People need to get paid, and the district needs to go on.
So that raises the question, how often has this happened? How many schools have gone into receivership? And then how often do schools get out of receivership and get rolling again on their own fiscally?
From 1991 to now, about the last 18 years, we've had 9. For the 10 or 12 years before that, we had 28, I think. So what happened was when the Richmond School District got a loan back in early 90s, there was a bill. It was called AB 1200. It was authored by Delaine Easton, who later became the state superintendent. And it established some oversight measures, what we use now. And so I think it's been very effective over time. So that's the budget review and those interim reports. That bill created an organization called FICMAT, the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistance Team. So there's lots of work that goes around monitoring and oversight to help with that process.
And of those 9, how many are still in receivership right now?
4 still have loans. 3 of those districts have what we call a trustee. 1 of those districts has an administrator where they have full control of the district.
These would be the individuals that step in to take over.
Correct.
In place of the school board or the superintendent. Who directs and guides those people?
It's called a state takeover. And it's called a state administrator, where the state comes in and has control. That responsibility has shifted back to the county office. We don't have any districts that have gone bankrupt and gotten a loan under this new process. So I don't know exactly how it will work. But what I do know is for the 4 districts that still have outstanding loans, in 3 of the cases, we had a state trustee, and I'll explain that. In 1, we had a state administrator. We had contracts with them. So we had to revise those contracts to turn them back to the county so that the county now is responsible for those districts. Back to the administrator versus trustee, when the loan is significantly large.
Such as
if the loan request is 200 times the amount of their recommended reserve for economic uncertainties. So that's the amount that they're required to set aside for reserves. Then they require a state administrator. And what that means, I say state administrator, now I guess it's a county administrator, but it's hard to change that term. That person comes in and essentially runs the district. They act as the superintendent. They act as the board. They kind of have full control and they work with the community. There are lots of laws surrounding how they are supposed to act and who, you know, they're supposed to consult with people, but ultimately the decisions are theirs, along with now the county office. It used to be the state.
So whichever school district might go into receivership mm-hmm. next becomes the school district that goes through this process mm-hmm. since the change in the law for
yes.
the first time. And there's still state involvement because
yes.
the state gives the county a list of people to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
The county puts them in place. The school district pays for those people.
The state superintendent still has a role. The State Board of Education has a role. FICMAT is kind of in an oversight role as well.
To help the school district get out of that situation. So maybe a district would want to go into receivership because it's run out of cash and it has no choice. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't a school district want to go into receivership?
I think two primary reasons. One is it loses control of the district. The board members become advisory only. They don't have a specific role. They don't get paid. The district superintendent is no longer there. It is the administrator that comes in and takes over. So while the administrator is working with the locals, ultimately it's this person's decisions that kind of control the district. And the goal is to get them out of receivership. And the other reason is it's expensive. It's a state loan that can take up to 20 years to repay. There's interest. They're paying for the trustee or the administrator. They're paying for additional studies that might have to be done. They're paying for an audit that's probably more expensive. So it's not necessarily a cheap proposition.
What's the range of loan amounts that you've seen in receiverships?
In recent history, in the last 18 years or so, I think the low has been $1.5 million-ish, and the large was $100 million. That was Oakland Unified.
So as we move forward, are there any other anticipated changes to the process? It is somewhat new because of what just shifted last fall. On the other hand, it's a process that has been in place and that has been working for a few decades now for schools that need it.
That's hard to say. There have been, since AB 1200 was first enacted, changes along the way in some ways to strengthen some of those requirements and some, say, tweaks along the way. This is kind of a fundamental shift, moving the primary responsibility back to the county. So it's hard to say as we kind of work through this process. And it's also, I think, a reality that with each specific emergency loan, there are sometimes little different conditions that are assigned to them. And so depending on the next one to come up, there might be some nuance, something that people feel is necessary to add to the legislation.
This has been a lesson in receivership. We aren't applying it to any specific district at this point. Is there anything else to know about it? The trigger, again, as you said, would be a district running out of cash. That doesn't seem to be anything arbitrary.
No, I would just say it's not a lot of fun for anybody, right? And I think whatever can be done to kind of forestall that and avoid that would be good. You know, whatever people can do to work together, whatever, you know, the county is, I think, willing to step in and help. We're willing to step in and help. And so we hope that things work themselves out, as many of them have in the past.
That was Karen Moore, director of the School Fiscal Services Division for the California Department of Education. We talked in May of 2019. There's more at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to an encore episode of Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. More now of our civics lesson. Let's take a look at bonding. This is a way for cities, school districts, and other entities to raise money, which sounds simple enough, but the topic can be complicated, confusing, and political. In June of 2019, we talked with Patrick Murphy. He's policy director of fiscal and governance reform and a senior fellow at PPIC, the Public Policy Institute of California. We started our conversation with a bit of a primer on bonding.
It's borrowing money, in this case, government borrowing money. And the individual analogy is the home mortgage, student loans. Sometimes people borrow for cars. I mean, all of those sort of big investments where you don't have the money right then, where you're going to have to go to someplace else to see if they'll lend you the money, and then you're going to have to pay it back with interest over time.
So where does that pot of money come from typically? What would be the norm?
Basically, if a government has gotten the authority to go out and borrow, they will issue bonds. They get the help of someone who will underwrite them, a lot of times one of the investment banks or Goldman Sachs type entity. And they put together a package and then they put it out there for investors. And those investors can vary from individuals who like to have municipal bonds as part of the one of the things that's in their portfolio, A lot of times we'll see it much more of institutions. So things like retirement funds, pensions, public pensions could invest in them as well. Insurance companies like them, they're very stable typically. They don't return as much interest, but at the same time, you know that over the life of that investment, a lot of times 30 years, you're going to get that return.
I'll stay with the home mortgage comparison. Is a term 15 years, 30 years? Is the rate adjustable on a bond at times?
Yes to all of it. The time length could be different depending on the application. 30 years is a real common one. Variable rates are one possibility. You can also have it fixed. And then again, sticking with the analogy, you can also refinance them, right? A government could go out and agree to pay back the money at 4% interest, and interest rates go down, and given the size of it, it might make sense to go out and issue new bonds at a lower rate, pay off the old ones. So that same comparison still holds.
In purchasing a house, pick a number. A house can be a few hundred thousand, it could be many millions. So what about a municipal bond? Is there a typical kind of range for an amount that a bond will be, or is it as wide-ranging as a home mortgage might be?
I would almost say even more so. Let's just take school districts. There's a school district on the coast just north of San Francisco that has fewer than 200 kids. They might go out and borrow $1 million to make some improvements on their buildings. LA Unified will go out and borrow hundreds of millions of dollars, and we can have everything in between.
When people are asked to vote for a bond goes before a community. Do you think they're likely to vote for it? Is it a concept that people are hesitant about? And how informed does your research say people are about bonds and bonding?
So I can speak from PPIC research on people's attitudes towards bonds, which generally, and when we ask the question, it's often put as for this particular purpose, and a lot of times education is one of them, but we can talk about water, etc. Generally, people are predisposed, especially if you ask, are you supporting a bond for fill in the blank, water infrastructure, improving schools, improving higher ed? Now, the interesting thing is when we also ask Californians about taxes, we generally get, if you will, the opposite. It's tougher to get a majority of people to support that. Some research that others have done have found out that when you put in, are you in favor of a bond, and then explain in the rest of the question what it is that the bond is, which is borrowing money, which is going to have to be paid back over time, et cetera, you'll not be surprised to know support goes down. It goes down kind of on average, depending on the way it's structured, about 5%. That suggests to me that people aren't real informed. They see bond and they somehow think it's kind of magic money. That just comes to the government and, oh, that must be a good thing. We really want to have that new building built or that infrastructure invested in.
Patrick, will you explain when voter approval is required for bonding? Because that's not always the case.
At what time does a government have to go to the voters to get permission to borrow money? That's what's really happening, right? That could be quite a low number for a small entity. You don't want to take the Los Angeles extreme case, them having to go borrow, say, $1 million to smooth out their cash flow. That's kind of small potatoes in that structure. Whereas if they want to go out and borrow tens of millions of dollars to build something, yes, then they have to go to the voters. Different jurisdictions will vary. We have different thresholds in California. In some cases, you could borrow money with a simple majority vote. Schools and community colleges know to borrow. We lowered that threshold to 55%, and we saw actually quite a big jump when we did that in terms of districts going out and asking the voters for approval and voters meeting that 55% threshold. And then a lot of cases, it's a two-thirds majority.
Why are bonds a popular choice? Why are they special or different?
The simple thing is in the same way that we as individuals want to or need to borrow or feel like we want to borrow money, we don't have the big chunk of money now and we have the need now. So we want to invest in the house or we want to invest in the college education. Municipalities are similar. They see it as if we can invest the money now, we'll get a return, be that sort of good things for our citizens, or in some cases actually a return in the idea of economic growth, that over time it's going to, in a sense, generate more economic activity, we'll have more sales tax, and that'll be good for the city. From investor standpoint, I should note, there's the attraction of the fact that most of the time, much of the time, tax exempt, which enables them to be priced a little bit lower. So it's cheaper money for the municipality. Why? Because federal government's given them this tax break to the investor. So they won't pay taxes on the money they make on the interest side of it.
Let's get to how a bond is paid back.
Usually a schedule will be set up when the bond is issued. It can vary again. A lot of times you'll see for governments, maybe twice a year payments, but it can be structured, as you can imagine, if you've ever gone out to look at mortgages and been completely overwhelmed by all these variations, the bond world is not much different. When the bond is put out there to investors to invest in, it'll be explicit in terms of what the expectations, where the money's going to come from. And that could range from what are referred to as general obligation bonds, general money coming in to the, say, in the case of a school district, just the money that comes in terms of revenue, the money that they get from property taxes, the money they get from the state of California. You could also sort of tie that revenue to a certain stream of taxes, say a special tax you've put out, and say, from now on, that money that comes in on that special tax first will pay off the bond. It's almost like if you were to borrow money yourself and then take on a part-time job and say, okay, the money that I get from that part-time job is going to go just to that and try to sort of dedicate that stream of revenue. We do have some cases where governments will do things like build a parking ramp and then say all the money that we get mm-hmm. by having people pay for the parking is going to go to that.
Right. So some of this is the future gamble. That future gamble, just like with a home mortgage, is what will my payments be and how likely am I able to meet them? There's no getting around this aspect of bonding, is there?
No. I mean, you are going to have to take a look at your expectations, you being the borrower, in terms of your own, for lack of a better term, cash flow, right? Money coming in. If you feel like that is optimistic, you may be more aggressive in how much you borrow. In other words, how big your payments are going to be going back to the people you borrow it from. Again, not to beat it too much, but on the mortgage, do you buy the house that's a real stretch? That means that a bigger chunk of your pay that you have today is going to go to pay down that mortgage. Or do you sort of dial it back a little bit and be a little bit more conservative and say, well, that's a mortgage payment I can handle, and therefore I'm going to go with that and I won't be lying there staring at the ceiling at night.
But what happens if an entity, a municipality, makes a gamble that fails? They end up short of revenue, they can't pay back the full interest, or the group goes bankrupt. What then?
First, I'd start with the fact that a municipal bond's defaults are really rare. They do happen, but we're talking probably less than 1%. So in the finance world, very rare, which is why investors like them, right? Very safe. When that does happen, it will depend on the kind of agreement, the way the money was borrowed. A lot of times, particularly to make it attractive to investors, the debt holders are in line first. And a lot of times they will get settled with in some way, shape, or form. And that could be, look, you're going to have to cut back operating expenses. In other words, lay people off, but we're still going to get our money. Kind of extreme case, you could actually sell off assets that the government entity has, the equivalent of a city selling off land that the firehouse is on, or a school selling off part of their land to pay it. Very extreme, very rare. But that's in the same way, again, that your house is the security for the person you borrowed money from. If you can't make the payments, at least they can get their money back out of the house.
And just to complete that, are there some examples that somehow PPIC has been involved in working on in municipalities having trouble paying back a bond? There's cities in our region that have been in this situation.
Probably the limit case is the Orange County bankruptcy of now several years ago, which involved both a lot of various financial factors that went into it. But essentially, then you have a similar thing where you're going to have to take a step back, figure out what money you have, and figure out a timing in which people are going to get paid back.
All right. So let me wrap us all the way back around. Why is it mysterious? Why does it become controversial?
Where the controversy comes, your vision, if you will, of what the benefits are going to be down the road to a city or school district, et cetera, versus my vision. And I may sort of say, wait a second, I just don't buy it. I don't believe what you say is going to happen. In other words, we're going to make this investment and these very positive things will go and flow from it. It's kind of your, if you will, cost-benefit analysis versus mine. And since neither of us, at least I don't, Beth, you might have a crystal ball hidden over there.
Nope.
But No, see, and so we don't know what the future is going to hold, right. And that's really that key variable that makes this. Neither of us can convince the other, right? What we're saying is, well, my projections say this, and it's based on these assumptions, and you can also counter that with some that might come to completely opposite decision.
Well, Patrick, I know it is a little dry, it is a little wonky, but because it comes up and there's this sort of assumption that, oh, bonds, bonding, yeah, we all know what that's all about. We thought it was worthwhile to spend a little bit of time going step by step through it, because most cities, most school districts, as you said, most entities are at some point going to go to a voter and ask the question, and maybe we help someone understand it a little bit better today.
I hope so, Beth. It's something that, you know, if you can't tell, I do get excited about. I'm a nerd, I admit it, but I'm sitting, you know, your listeners can't see me, but I'm waving my hands. It is an important topic, and it involves a lot of money.
That was my conversation with Patrick Murphy in June of 2019. He's Policy Director of Fiscal and Governance Reform and a Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. The Civics Lesson continues on Insight on CAP Radio. This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Our civics lesson shifts now to housing. In 2017, California lawmakers were focused on bills to address the state's housing shortage. At that time, CAP Radio's podcast series, The View From Here, Place and Privilege, captured the work of four reporters who spent most of a year exploring various aspects of housing problems. In one episode titled Not Up to Code, former CAP Radio reporter Amy Quinton tracked her ride along with Sacramento County's code enforcement team.
I focus specifically on what are called problem properties. These are properties that have failed inspections twice in 1 year. It becomes a problem property. And they run the gamut in terms of what problems they are, but this is really something that drains the resources of code enforcement. They spend a large portion of their time dealing with these properties.
So offhand, I would think about cockroaches, water damage or mold, maybe garbage. Tell me more about the problems.
So there are five priority issues that they look at that they have to respond to in between 24 and 72 hours. One is a lack of heat. The other one is a lack of water. It has to have both hot and cold water. The other one is a lack of electricity. And surfacing sewage is the other issue. But they also have structural issues. If there's a safety issue, like a balcony collapsing, that they also have to respond to. Those are the big things that you see in some of these problem properties.
A lack of heat, for example, won't be so obvious. But you did ask the code enforcement officer that you rode along with what some of the worst is, some of what he saw. And let's listen just to a clip of your podcast episode.
Oh, I've seen massive infestations where bed bugs have literally taken over entire complexes, where kids are bit from head to toe just from bed bug bites alone. I've seen water leaks so bad where every room in an entire upstairs apartment complex is covered from wall to wall with mold, where I couldn't even go into the room because I couldn't breathe. It was so bad infested with mold. And here it is, we got children living in those areas for months at a time.
Now, these circumstances are horrendous. How rare is that in the county?
Unfortunately, it's not rare. It's surprising. But like I said, this is also the worst of the worst that I saw. But it's not rare. You get more common problems like some of the mold issues because some of these buildings are 50, 60, 70 years old. And if you don't keep up the maintenance, you're going to run into these problems.
But these problems aren't always in low rent places, are they?
No. In fact, most of them aren't. They're market rate apartments. And that was pretty surprising to me that someone can charge that much and still have these basically these living conditions that no one would really want to live in.
Let me give a fuller picture of your podcast. You went along with a man named Tim King and describe his job.
He is the senior code enforcement officer. So he leads a team of seven code enforcement officers that do the rental housing inspection program. They inspect total, the whole program, they inspect 50,000 properties, but they're designed, the program's designed to get to all of them once every 5 years. That's how it's set up. A lot of property owners self-certify, and then the rental housing inspection program will audit those. I did a ride-along with Tim King looking at some of these properties and talking to him about some of the conditions that he sees.
So that's sort of a Golden Gate Bridge approach where they do the whole cycle and come back around. But you said that complaints that they investigate at least two times a year or more are subject to fines or penalties, I guess. Who's doing the reporting? How are they finding where to return?
Well, they get approximately 200 complaints a month, and they can come, they do often come from tenants, but they can also come from near neighbors or nearby businesses, especially if you have a lot of crime going on in some of these apartment complexes. You know, a neighbor will call and complain about it. They also hear from property managers because it's the owner that is responsible for the problems. So sometimes they hear from property managers that just say, hey, this isn't being taken care of.
Amy, and what we heard earlier, though, the problems were going on for a long time. I mean, if bed bugs have taken over a complex or children are living in a room that's been mold infested, at what point should a tenant make a report? And is fear a factor here in why it's not spoken about sooner?
Fear is definitely a factor. Even though the law says that a owner or a property manager cannot retaliate, they cannot kick you out because you've called code enforcement, they cannot raise your rent because you called code enforcement, there's still that fear that that will happen. And if you do end up, you can sue them for doing that. You can sue the property owner for doing that, but you obviously have to have a case. And, you know, that's a little intimidating for people.
Mm. And at what point can you file a complaint? Is there any kind of a time limitation or statute?
Well, before you file a complaint, Tim King says that you should always first contact the owner. And if you do call to complain, that's what they're going to tell you. Contact the owner. Give them a little bit of time, depending on what it is. If it's one of these issues where you have no heat and it's, you know, December or February, then they're going to respond immediately. But you should definitely tell the owner as soon as you can.
Tim King tells you this is dangerous business.
It is dangerous. And that was really surprising, too. He wears a bulletproof vest when he goes out on inspections. His entire team does, even though he drives a Prius. The whole inspection team drives a Prius. But they have to. They run into some really dangerous situations. Sometimes they're in a bad neighborhood where there might be drug violence going on. They just don't know. And this actually came about from an incident where an animal control officer, of all things, knocked on a door, and the guy that was behind the door just kind of freaked out, and she was shot. So they take this very seriously, and he has a law enforcement background.
Hmm. What about renovations or fixes to the complaints? Are they done? Does that happen? What's the follow-up?
They are done. They are required to be done. Now, you know, code enforcement works with property owners to get these things fixed. They will give them a plan. If a property owner, for example, can't afford to get them fixed, they will give them time to give them fixed. Sometimes they'll give them up to 5 years, depending on what it is. I mean, if it's something minor, if they have to replace all the windows, you know that's not going to take a day or two. So they do work with property owners to do that. But there's a series of enforcement actions that they can take. They can fine them. They can fine them several times, from $100, I think, to $1,000 a day. Mm-hmm. And they've been known to give fines of $30,000, depending on, you know, how long the problem has gone on.
I want to touch on something you and Tim King talked about, and that is that there are the worst of the worst properties, and sometimes they come up over and over again. And let's go back to a clip from the podcast where he describes yet some other circumstances that he's seen that are horrendous again.
Some of the, probably the worst cockroach infestations I've ever been in. Most of the flooring was moving when you'd walk in. So, I mean, it wasn't like you had one or two cockroaches. Like, the floor was literally moving. I've seen enough infestations and dealt with them that when you start seeing the little babies run around, means they're mating. And so when they're mating, they're multiplying at a very high pace rate. And when you see the babies that are rocking around, be mindful that these cockroaches are nocturnal creatures. So they only come out at night. So when you're in there during the daytime and you see that many cockroaches, you can imagine how many actually come out at night.
Pretty horrific.
Yeah, and there must be relationships here. Code enforcement must know property owners because sometimes they're dealing with them not just in one year, but multiple years, right?
They are, and some are very well known to code enforcement, some of the repeat offenders. Sometimes it's actually a situation where an investor has come in and bought a property, and it's changed hands so many times. They're buying a property they haven't seen, and there's many problems. So it's just a case of, well, I didn't know the property look like this. Outside investors that don't even live in the state, that can also be a problem. So it sort of runs the gamut.
It's one thing to do a story and say this problem exists and this is how bad it is. And honestly, some of the descriptions that Tim gives you in this story are pretty surprising, especially to the degree that they're out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've seen bad apartments before, but to hear him describe it and to hear how often it happens, I think it's just not known to a lot of people that these apartment complexes exist in such bad conditions and that people are forced to live in these conditions. And some of it may be because they've had an eviction on their record for whatever reason. And, you know, some of these properties, they just won't do a background check on tenants. Tim King talked a lot about that. So they're stuck in these places sometimes.
But moving this forward, Amy, why is the code enforcement team only 7, for example? And if the problem is getting bigger, does the county need to throw more resources at code enforcement?
I don't know that the problem is getting bigger, but yeah, I'm surprised that there's 14 in the entire program, but others are doing audits. Others are doing registrations. All property owners have to register their property. But it does sound like such a small amount of employees doing such a big job. But that's the way the county set up the program.
That was former CAP Radio reporter Amy Quinton in the fall of 2017 as she was riding with Sacramento County's code enforcement team. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Affordable housing issues continue to pose a statewide crisis for renters and homeowners across California. In the fall of 2017, wildfires were pushing the crisis into an emergency. I talked with Ben Metcalf, the Director of Housing and Community Development. Governor Jerry Brown was still in office then, and Director Metcalf and I discussed a package of housing bills making its way through the legislature. He put the housing emergency into perspective.
First, let me just say my heart goes out to all the folks who are contending with the housing challenges that they've faced as a consequence of these fires. Mm. What we've seen is that 4 folks fleeing the fires in Napa and Sonoma elsewhere, they're contending with a very, very tight housing market. The Bay Area is in many ways sort of ground zero of the housing affordability crisis. To give you an example, we estimate that probably over the last 5 years, only about 65,000 new homes have been added at a time when almost 500,000 new jobs have been created. That incredible imbalance of folks trying to come into the Bay Area, folks trying to access new jobs, but simply not enough housing, has caused rents to go up and home prices to soar.
So what role does your department have now? It was a large number of communities, middle-income communities. Where do you play a part in what will happen next?
at my department, the Department of Housing and Community Development, it joins the Housing and Community Development Task Force that's facilitated both by the federal disaster agency FEMA and by the California Office of Emergency Services. So we'll be assisting both with immediate issues related to the rebuilding as well as strategizing on ways to get more funding into these communities to help homeowners and communities rebuild and repair.
Lawmakers' approach and the governor's signing of new laws looked at the state as a whole and where there was either middle ground or a compromised place that could help from north to south. Now we have this swath of Northern California in particular hit by the wildfires. Is there a special and particular need and focus that will have to happen from the Bay Area across to Reno because of what we just experienced?
Just to put this in context, I think we're all digesting this, but the estimates now are perhaps 6,700 homes have been destroyed in the North Bay. In a given year, in the last 5 or 10 years in the Bay Area, we've only built maybe 10 to 15,000 homes. So in a single week, we've sort of taken out half of the Bay Area's annual production of new housing. So that's going to be felt in pretty immediate ways. And we're going to have to get creative. I mean, I think right now the focus is just temporary transitional opportunities to house folks. And luckily, there are resources with vouchers, temporary housing accommodations. But we are going to have to figure out how to facilitate that rebuilding and to do more, right, to actually go in and try and build much more housing than that which we lost.
We're still in the midst of it. I just realized I sounded like I was talking past tense. Crisis or emergency, those words aren't even adequate.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me add to this a point that the Sacramento Bee made in an article. There was a quote from Noreen Evans. She's an environmental attorney who represented part of Santa Rosa in the legislature. And she said, "I worry about a mass exodus. Some people were on the verge of leaving before this. The long-term implications are that we'll become more economically stratified. Young people won't be able to live here. And then we run the risk of becoming old, white, and affluent." And she was talking maybe specifically about her community, but there have been a number of factors pushing people out of California before. Do you think this will be a big push?
It will increase the push that's already going on. And she's absolutely right. The data show that we've been seeing significant net outmigrations of California households over the last several years as a direct consequence of the housing affordability crisis. I think the last year it was 110,000 California households who out-migrated. And when you think about that, it's very perverse because California is a booming economy. It's a wonderful place to raise a family. By all rights, we should be attracting people to this great state, not having them leave. And when you parse that 110,000, you find that a disproportionate number of those folks are lower income. They are communities of color. They are millennials. They are folks who are just not able to get a toehold. Mm. And yet they should be part of a vibrant and diverse California. I think the California that many of us came here as or were born here thinking that this is what we were going to find. And now we're finding a very stratified state. This compounds a bad problem.
There was an important resource, the statewide housing assessment. How did that factor into all of this? It seems like some of the numbers are even changing or being updated from when that report was first issued.
Yes, we are working on an update to the document that we published on our website, hcd.ca.gov, this past January. But it was the first comprehensive housing report for the state that we have done in almost 15 years. And it laid out in a pretty stark way the magnitude of the housing crisis and its multifaceted implications. And then also put forward a policy framework for a response. Ultimately, it became a very helpful document for guiding the legislative conversations that happened over the last session. It sort of anchored everybody in numbers and facts and offered up a way to think about the problem that allowed us to see that, you know, there is no silver bullet. This has been a problem decades in the making through a whole bunch of different policy decisions at the local and state level. Any response has to be, again, multifaceted and comprehensive and involve answers at the local and state level. And what we were able to do when the governor signed this legislative housing package, thanks to incredible leadership in the legislature, was move the ball forward in a very meaningful way. But by no means is the problem solved. By no means can we sort of check the box and move on. And
in fact, a lot of people will say and have said in this studio, Director, that this is only a very small start. It's only a very minute beginnings to what needs to be done.
I would not characterize as a minute or a small step. I think it's a very, I would call it a meaningful step and a sea change. And I think, you know, the jury is out in terms of the ways in which we shift behaviors at the local level. And the jury is out to some degree in terms of how impactful ultimately these state dollars are in leveraging the full suite of new investments that we hope to see. But I do think that it signals the turn of the tide, if you will, in terms of a willingness by elected officials to start to make hard decisions. I mean, this is unequivocally the most significant housing package the state has seen in decades. And I think it reflects the fact that there is this widespread sense that housing has to be tackled. And again, it's not just a state issue. I think if you look at our statewide housing assessment, you'll see a lot of our recommendations are at the local level, actions that it will take, tough city ordinances that will need to get passed or changes in policy that will need to happen at the cities and counties. But I think this gets the ball rolling in the right direction.
There is a pilot program in Los Angeles to build backyard housing for homeless people. And the homeless conversation is an important aspect of this whole issue. What about that pilot program or any others that you see significant potential for?
The LA model is really interesting. It'll be a question as to the scalability of it. They're basically offering homeowners assistance to build an accessory dwelling unit in their backyard if they're willing to take a homeless individual there. I love the creativity. Ultimately, I think that probably much of what will need to happen on homelessness is building on the infrastructure and the best practices that we've already been making headway on, by which I mean really doubling down on investing into permanent supportive housing, so subsidized affordable housing linked to services. And we now have a lot of new funding at the local and state level to do that. Really investing into the data IT systems and tracking mechanisms that our local governments use to actually identify where the homeless are and who they are, by name registries, making sure we're doing things like coordinated entry. And we have resources also through the housing package to really build out that capacity.
Well, you're seeing all of the social issues and concerns it raises very much on display in Sacramento this week as the mayor leads these conversations about where two centers possibly will be placed in the city.
Yeah. And look, this is tough work. I think we've actually been very impressed by the willingness of the voters of California and voters in local jurisdictions to say, hey, we've got to do something about homelessness. But when it comes to siting those same facilities in their own neighborhoods, sometimes people go right back to where they were and say, well, not in my backyard. And so this is a challenging issue. Even if we can get the political will at the city level, we're going to have folks at every level step forward and say, yep, I'm prepared to be a part of a positive change here.
There is this packet of laws that has been passed. And in a broader sense, there is a very vibrant statewide dialogue now on housing. That's not going to be put back in a box. That's out there in the open. How powerful is the awareness and the dialogue at the level that it became this year compared to where we were?
I would say that if you asked just about any sort of housing advocate or housing activist a year ago, if they thought that we would be where we are today, both in terms of the housing crisis continuing, but also specifically in terms of the ability of the state to have taken the action that it did, nobody would have believed you. We were able to get something done that I think sort of defied the odds in terms of the magnitude and comprehensive of that state package. And again, I would just say this gets to the fact that I think something is changed a little bit in terms of the political will, the sort of felt pain by legislators in terms of responding to this as a top concern for their constituents.
That said, what will or should the focus be in the next session when housing comes up again? And does it change because of what we're experiencing with the emergency of the wildfires?
It very well may. And there may be things that we need to do to think creatively about Napa and Sonoma and the laws that we've put in place to make sure that those are moving as quickly as possible, that the funding is getting out there as quickly as possible. We have a lot of work, I would say, on just the implementation side to make sure we get it right. Great laws were passed. Now we need to do the work of actually figuring out nuts and bolts, how to administer those great new laws. And again, I also think it's going to come to local jurisdictions to sort of step up and take advantage of these new opportunities at the state level. Folks, you know, cities are going to have to retool their planning departments and rethink their housing programs. They're going to have to start building out capacity and hiring new staff at the local level. And so my hope is that we can work constructively hand in hand with those cities and counties to get them to the place they need to be.
It's interesting listening from my chair to state officials, state level officials say we really need the local level folks to step up. And local level folks say we really need the partnership of the state. And everybody's saying the federal government has a role to play here. So at least it verifies for me that everybody's looking to link agencies and resources and be part of the solution.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a great example. On the, you mentioned homelessness. We last week just kicked off our first statewide interagency coordinating council meeting on homelessness, which brought together local representatives, every state agency that administers homeless funds. That now is a place where we're beginning to really bring together all those threads and think comprehensively about tough problems. I know we're doing that in homelessness. I know we're doing that right now on the disasters. It's got to be an interagency solution.
That was Ben Metcalf, the California Director of Housing and Community Development, talking with me in October of 2017. We have continuing coverage of the housing shortage and of wildfires. You can find it at capradio.org. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Insight is produced by Kate Gonzalez and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Munez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.